General Lloyd Owen, Real One. When was it that you joined the Long Range Desert Group, General?
It was in about July of 1941, a year after it was first formed.
How did it come about that you joined?
I was stationed in Cairo at that time, teaching at the Officer Cadet Training Unit, the OCCHU, which I wasn't greatly enjoying, and very keen to get back into the desert. And I happened to run across a friend of mine who I didn't know at the time that I saw him that he was in this organization, but he had joined it in December of 1940, and he told me a little bit about it.
Can you remember what he said about it?
Oh, I can remember exactly. He was in the Coldstream Guards and had joined the Guards patrol of the Long Range Desert Group, which was formed when they expanded after the initial successes. And this was in December of 1940. And he had been down on the early raids that they did into the Fezzan. And he described a little bit, although he was a bit reticent telling me what he'd been up to, but he told me a little bit of what he'd been doing, and I was terribly excited by the whole thing.
What was it that excited you about it?
Well, it was the fact that they'd been operating independently at enormous distances away behind the lines. I can't remember the details now of how far that patrol was, but it was something like 1,600 kilometres away from the base in Cairo. They'd been working in conjunction with the French, who'd come up from Chad, and they'd had a most successful operation because it was so unexpected. It was a surprise, and the general... I suppose there was some kind of Bergère's glamour in it that must have appealed to me, but I liked the idea and I wanted very much to get out of Cairo.
Perhaps at this stage we had better say what the role of the Long Range Desert Group was.
Yes, when it was first formed in June of 1940, Ralph Bagnall, who founded it, was a man of great vision, and he had seen, before the Italians declared war in June of 1940, that the whole of the flank of the British Empire position in the Middle East was likely to be threatened by the Italian garrisons that there were deep down in the desert in places such as Kufra and Oinat. And he was wise enough to write a paper on this threat and to prove that it was really essential for the Commander-in-Chief, who was then General Wavell, to know what was going on in the inner desert. And he produced this paper with this idea of forming a special unit with special equipment and the ability to carry out deep reconnaissance into the desert. And that was the original role of the Long Range Desert Group. It was to gain intelligence of what was going on in the inner desert. But at the same time, he was wise enough to realize that you couldn't keep men purely doing that kind of thing, and that they must have an offensive role as well. And as they had all the equipment for moving and the ability to move vast distances in the desert, they were able to act offensively when it was necessary.
Did you meet Bagnall yourself much?
Yes, I knew him quite well. In fact, I went for my first interview with him. When I applied to join the Long Range Desert Group, he at that time was a lieutenant colonel in the Royal Signals. He had done a very great deal of exploration in the desert before the war in the 1920s and 30s with a whole lot of other friends of his in the army who were like-minded, and they had done remarkable journeys by any standards in T-model Fords, and they had overcome all the problems of living, existing, navigating, and finding out about the desert of which practically nothing was known. I mean, there were no maps, for instance, at that time. Anyhow, to go back to Bagnold, he is still alive, he's 91. His mind is as clear as anything still. He is getting old, of course, at that age, but he is probably, and I think without doubt, the greatest living expert on deserts in the world. After all, even before the war, he published a book called The Physics of Blown Sand, which describes how sand dunes were formed. And you may not know, but some of those sand dunes went up to 400 and 500 feet high. Now, as I say, Bagnold is still alive. He is a very remarkable man. He had the vision of this thing because he had done so much before the war, and he knew that if he was given the go-ahead by the commander-in-chief when he was went to see him, he could raise this unit, the long-range desert group.
What about your own familiarity with the desert? Had you had any familiarity at all before the LRDG?
Mighty little. I had gone out to Palestine at the end of 1938, having joined the army at the beginning of 1938, and I was in Palestine when the war started, and then during 1940, we went down, moved down across the Suez Canal to the Western Desert, and I was involved in the very first early campaign at Sidi Barani and Tobruk and those kind of things. That was the only time that I had been in the desert, I suppose probably for 4 or 5 months. I knew very little about it. I knew very little about anything. I was virtually ignorant on things like vehicles. I knew a little bit about communications because I had been my regimental signal officer at the beginning of the war. But one must remember, of course, that we hardly had wireless sets. We just had wireless sets. When I went out to Palestine in 1938, we were communicating with things like heliographs and lamps at night. We didn't have a wireless set between an outpost and a company headquarters or whatever it was. That's the way we communicated, and we had telephones. We laid line, and we started going into battle. I can remember very well laying line, because it was useless. The lines were all shot to pieces in no time, and people, of course, learnt as they went along. No, my knowledge of the desert was minimal.
So when Bagnold interviewed you, what type of things did he ask? Can you recollect?
He asked me an awful lot of questions to which I could hardly give any coherent answer, because he was a great expert. And only the other day I wrote to him and I said, I cannot think whatever made you take me on, because I was so totally and utterly green. Luckily, he didn't reply to that.
What was your role to be in the desert group once you got in?
The interesting thing, I suppose, was, and I'll just expand a little on this, that it was formed of men originally from the 2nd New Zealand Expeditionary Force. The men all came from there. They brought a few officers with them. Largely, the officers were those who had been with Bagnold before the war. After the initial very considerable successes of this organization, and they were very considerable, they expanded. And they expanded with patrols, as I mentioned a moment ago, from the Brigade of Guards, one patrol from the Brigade of Guards. They expanded with Rhodesians who were serving in the British Army, and they expanded with a yeomanry patrol. Well, it so happened that at the time that I applied to join, I knew that there was a chance of my meeting Brigadier Bagnold, because I knew General Wavell quite well, and he told me that he could arrange it. He also told me that he understood that there was a vacancy for an officer in the yeomanry patrol. Now, I was not a yeomanry. I was a regular infantry officer in the Queen's Royal Regiment, and I therefore thought my chances of acceptance were very remote indeed. However, nothing daunted, I went off and I was interviewed by Brigadier Colonel Bracknell, as he then was, and after presumably satisfying him to some extent that I had certain qualities, I suppose, he agreed to take me on. The problem then, of course, was that I was commanding a company at this OCTU in Cairo, and was to convince my commanding officer of that place that he would release me and allow me to join the long-range desert group. That was quite a considerable hurdle that I had to overcome.
But you were going to say how your role developed in the desert group.
Well, I then was accepted to command the yeomanry patrol. The fact of the matter was the man who had been commanding that patrol had been wounded, and there was a very definite vacancy, and they wanted somebody very urgently. I found myself, when I did eventually get away from Cairo, commanding 25 or so men, all of jolly good yeomanry regiments. There were with them a few Scotsmen from the Scottish Commando, because they had brought a whole lot of commandos out from the United Kingdom. There were no proper roles for them, and so these commandos as such were disbanded, and some of the men applied to join us. And so I had this patrol of 25 or so men of yeomanry, and the patrol was the basic unit of the long-range desert group throughout its existence right until the end of the war.
What was the purpose of the yeomanry patrol in relation to the others?
All the six patrols, I think, there were five patrols at that time. There were two New Zealand, one Guards, one Rhodesian, and one yeomanry. All of them carried out the same kind of task, but, of course, being formed of such very different kind of men, as you can see, a guardsman probably acts in a very different kind of way to a Rhodesian, and a yeomanry who is a part-time cavalry soldier probably again acts in a totally different way, and therefore the commanding officer had available to him a whole lot of instruments which he could play as he wished to do in an orchestra. If he was given some particular job that he thought the New Zealanders might be better at doing, he would select them rather than, say, the yeomanry, who may not have been quite so such handy men about their vehicles and things. Those New Zealanders were wonderful people, because they had learnt on farms and things like that about tractors and about vehicles. The yeomanry boys had only really, they'd come up with their horses. They sent a whole yeomanry division out to Palestine in 1939, after war was declared, with their horses. And can you imagine anything more futile than that? Where the devil anyone ever thought that they were going to fight with horses in 1940, I do not know. But so they were not very mechanically minded. Of course, they learnt remarkably quickly, because they were really high-class chaps. Every single man in the long-range desert group was a volunteer, and a selected volunteer at that.
So what were the special characteristics of the yeomanry patrol which could be exploited by Colonel Bagnold?
I think, having been brought up as cavalrymen, they were probably extremely good at the role for which we were primarily raised, and that is gaining information. This, after all, was largely the role of cavalry. They were mostly countrymen. The yeomanry regiments were all from the country, practically. Therefore, they had a great knowledge of the country. They were not ever scared of being alone on their own in the dark, which certain town-minded people certainly were. I mean, a man from the Brigade of Guards Not necessarily did they all come from the towns or cities, but an awful lot of them did. And they weren't so used, I think, to operating at night, operating on their own, using their initiative, as these yeomanry boys were. And they were exceedingly good, and I found them absolutely splendid kind of soldiers. They very different to having served, as I had, only for a very short time, with a regular infantry regiment. They were very different because they did not require constantly being told what to do. They were so used to being given a general direction and then left to get on with it. And this is what I find so fascinating and interesting and so easy to work with them.
As a newcomer to this patrol, did you find that you had to rely at first heavily on any individual or individuals?
Oh, yes, there's no question about it. After all, I'd only been in the army 18 months or whatever it was by the time that I joined. 2 years, I suppose. By the time that I joined, I knew very little. I was very raw. One had practically no experience of warfare, although luckily I had been in Palestine. I had been shot at, so I did know what a bullet sounded like when it missed you. And I'd been bombed by RAF aircraft dropping hand grenades out of Gladiator single-seater fighters. So I had seen a little bit of fire, which other people hadn't. So I had that little tiny advantage. But of course, I did have to rely very heavily when I first joined. They had been, they were formed in February of 1941, I think it was January, February 1941, the Yeomanry Patrol, and therefore by the time I actually got to them and actually was put in command, it was probably 6 months later than they had, since they had been formed. They therefore had operated a certain amount on their own in the desert and had 6 months more experience of the desert than I had. There was a whole new technique to learn. If you try to imagine that you are going to go behind the lines and remain behind the lines, for the first time that you ever do it, even though you are in pretty flat desert kind of country with very little cover, you expect to see the enemy over almost every rise. In fact, you are very surprised that you don't see them. It takes a long time to get used to the fact that there are not an awful lot of enemy away from the main areas of fighting, and therefore you've got a good deal to learn. You've got to learn the whole art of moving without unduly exhausting the men under your command in extremes of heat, and sometimes in pretty unpleasant cold weather, because it can be extremely cold early in the morning. You've got to nurture the provisions and the food and the water and the petrol and stuff that you have got. You've got to be extremely careful about all that sort of thing, because you are entirely dependent on your own selves. You will never get any form of replenishment or resupply, and therefore there is a very great deal to learn. And I lent very heavily, not only on my patrol sergeant, who was a splendid man, but also on one or two of the more experienced drivers and others, and gunners particularly, who taught me a great deal about operating weapons that I had never used. A Vickers 303 machine gun, for instance, with which we were armed. I'd never used one of those. Well, I reckoned I had to be pretty good at that. And so I learned from my little gunner, who travelled on the back of my vehicle. He taught me a great deal.
Can you remember the name of the sergeant?
Oh, yes, I remember his name well. He was Sergeant Carningham, and before the war he had been a chauffeur for somebody driving a Rolls-Royce. Sadly, he has been out of touch with us ever since I last saw him in 1943, when the desert campaign came to an end, and not one of us has ever seen or heard of him since. Maybe he went back to his unit and was killed in Europe or something of that sort. We don't know, but he was a very good chap with a marvellous sense of humour, And I think all the men in that portrayal liked him very much.
At first, when you joined them, presumably you were engaged in training, were you?
When I first joined, no, not really. They were refitting. They were brought back, having had 6 months or so up based at Siwa, and they were brought back to Cairo to refit and to replenish and to get themselves sorted out, have a bit of leave and everything else. And once that was all over, we went straight down to Kufra, which was the main base of the LRDG at that time. Kufra had been taken by the French in March of 1940 from the Italians and is about 600 miles to the south of Tobruk, and that was where we were operating from at that time.
Can you tell me about the equipment you had in the patrol?
Yes, when I first joined, we had 10 vehicles. They were 3,000 weight Chevrolets, capable of carrying anything up to 2 tons at least, or even 3 tons of load, each having 2 or 3 men, mostly 3 men on the vehicle. They were capable of travelling a distance of up to 1,800 miles and the patrol existing for up to 6 weeks from the point of view of food, ammunition, water, which was terribly important, and those kind of things. Water was quite unobtainable almost anywhere. There were some wells. You could get it in the main oases, of which there were very few. There were some wells of which we knew, but most of them had either been poisoned by the Germans if it was up on the coast, or poisoned by ourselves if it was up on the coast, or they were so filthy and rancid with camel dung and that kind of thing that unless we were really desperate, we never, ever drew any water. In fact, I can't really remember an occasion when we drew water anywhere, apart from passing through one of the oases on the way out to going further afield.
Did you have sterilizing tablets for water?
No, not that I can remember. Maybe we did, but we certainly wouldn't have bothered with that kind of thing. I mean, one got so awfully used to drinking filth. And I think everyone did drink a great deal of filth. You had jippy tummies and upset tummies and all that kind of thing. But once you were out in the desert, frankly, the atmosphere, the whole the heat and everything else kept illness at bay. Apart from desert sores on our legs and or any scratch that you would get, you virtually had no trouble of any sort. It was only when you got into towns or villages that you picked up these nasty jippy tummies and other things like that. On the whole, men were extremely healthy the whole time. You had to be. There wasn't a doctor with you. You had a medical orderly who was very limited in what he could do. You could get in touch with headquarters if there was some awful problem. Where the doctor back there would be able to advise on the wireless. Indeed, I think we had teeth extracted by medical orderlies on instructions from the doctor back at base, and a good deal of rum as acting as an anaesthetic. After all, we had a rum ration every day. Every man had a rum ration every day, and it was a very useful thing to have had.
Now, I interrupted your narrative with you going to Kufra Oasis. Can you tell me what happened there?
Well, we were going down there to join where the headquarters was at that time. Ralph Bagnold had himself handed over to Guy Prendergast, who was a colonel in the Royal Tank Regiment. Guy Prendergast had been with Ralph Bagnold before the war and knew as much about the desert as Ralph Bagnold did, and was a marvelous commanding officer. And we were going down there to join him down there with where the rest of the patrols were based. apart from the New Zealanders who were up at Siwa, which is about 200 miles south of Mersa Matru, they were operating direct from there at that time. All this was, I'm talking about the autumn of 1941, just before the Cunningham Offensive of November 1941, in which we were to take quite a considerable part.
Can you tell me about that?
Yes. That offensive, which started, I think, on the 17th of November 1941, was intended to sweep the enemy back towards Tripoli, and all was to be lovely in the garden once more. But our role was one purely of reconnaissance at the beginning of it. All our patrols were sent out at various distances behind the lines to watch and report at certain points of what was moving up towards the front or what might be withdrawing back towards Benghazi and Tripoli further back. That was our role at that stage. There were one or two other roles, particularly one connected with the collection of the SAS. David Stelling, who had formed the SAS and who were going to be involved in an offensive operation the night before the Cunningham battle began on the 17th of November.
Can you tell me about how you carried out those roles?
Well, in my own particular case, I was sent to, I haven't got a map in front of me, to a place called Bir Ten Jedda, where one imagined that there might be a well and perhaps a house or two, having seen it on the map. Of course, there was nothing of the sort when one got there. My own particular role was to watch a track and report any movement that I saw or any aircraft movement that I saw or heard, and to stay there until I was given further orders. In the event, I spent 10 days or so sitting there and saw absolutely nothing whatsoever until a few days after I had arrived there. I can't now remember the date without looking it up. Paddy Main, who was David Stirling's, one of David Stirling's great operators, was seen walking across the desert with nine men. And a few hours later, David Stirling himself and a couple of men came in walking through me, having been dropped. I knew they were going to be dropped. They were dropped on two airfields at Tamimi and Gazala. And the object of the exercise was for them to destroy all the aircraft on those two airfields the night before the offensive was due to start. In the event, it was terrible weather. They were dropped miles from their objective. Those who dropped them had no experience of dropping parachutes.